Mrs. Segundo, as an award-winning, best-selling writer of many successful memoirs and pseudo-histories, as a disreputable type who has been called the most shameless biographer since Kitty Kelly, I'd very much like to write about you.
Why?
There are no experiences I have that might be construed as commercially viable, and it remains my belief that if I burrow into your memories, I might very well puncture a few truths about your relationship with Mr. Segundo.
Is this a proposition?
It is, ma'am. You can tell me everything there is to know about Mr. Segundo. We might find a way to tarnish the man's reputation and sell more books. I'd even throw in a few complimentary sessions of cunnilingus.
What makes you think that I need more money, wish to share my story, or want your mouth anywhere near my nookie?
I have reason to believe that the alimony payments and the KY are beginning to dry up.
There's no need to be insulting during a business discussion.
And there's no reason to consider a business decision without being profoundly insulting.
Okay, so I am here with Laura Lipman, who is most recently the author of Life Sentences. Laura, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm doing all fine. Doing fine. I wanted to first of all ask, with a general state of inspiration, your protagonist, Cassandra Fallows, has very striking similarities to Catherine Harrison. Both Harrison and Cassandra have written two memoirs and have also dabbled in fiction. There's a fiction that doesn't receive quite the attention because of the memoirs, because the memoirs are so successful. There's the true crime element. They're both around the same age. So I must ask if Catherine Harrison was perhaps an inspiration for Cassandra, or there was perhaps another muse. Were there any memoirists who she was really based on, or what?
She wasn't based on anyone actual, and it's really funny because it kind of goes to the novel, which is so much about how the mind works. Until this very moment, I have never thought about the similarities between Cassandra and Catherine Harrison.
Uh-huh.
It just wasn't on my radar. I think in part because, didn't Catherine Harrison write fiction first? And that might seem almost fiction and then she... But at any rate, Catherine Harrison, I didn't have any specific model. I had many, many, many models, and I was thinking about a certain kind of memoir, which is generally received as, you know, interesting and good and heartbreaking, but to my mind, has a certain kind of smarmy breathlessness about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually don't have a really high opinion of Cassandra Fallows as a writer,
yeah,
which might sound very funny, and, you know, having written in her voice and published these excerpts of her memoir. To me, Cassandra is the kind of writer that a lot of people think is a good writer, but she's not my kind of writer. And she was a really specific, peculiar character who sort of arrived in my head complete. And it wasn't, oh, I'm going to take three parts of this writer and seven parts of this writer and mix them up. It was, no, this is the character. She is a writer. She was very specific in my imagination.
Yeah. So the memoir, in fact, dictated the memoirist in this case.
Yes. Yes. There's this truth that Cassandra keeps tiptoeing around for the entire book, which is that the story of her life is she was a lonely little girl. And, of course, she's made it so much bigger. I mean, she thinks it is so much bigger. Cassandra knows that the story of her life is not that she was a lonely little girl whose parents got divorced, but that she was a lonely little girl whose father left her mother for a woman he met at one of the most important events of the decade. You know, that she sees herself as so much larger than life. She says her life story is much bigger than other people's. So yeah, the story of Cassandra's life as seen by Cassandra,
yeah,
is absolutely what created the character.
But I should also point out that over the course of this novel, you do peck away at Cassandra's apparent sophistication. I mean, at the end, you kind of reveal her to be a rube. I mean, early on, she refers to her second marriage as a prime example of Hegelian synthesis, and this is used to justify her cheating on her husband. And then by the end of the book, quite startlingly, Cassandra is calling a quarter pounder disturbingly good, Proustian good, which is a rather alarming comparative factor to this mass-produced burger that people I'm not sure enjoy, but certainly eat. But I must I must ask, I mean, how did you hit upon this use of a literary modifier to portray this sharp disparity between here is someone who thinks that she is being sophisticated with this literary name dropping, and yet, or rather the prose, which is interesting, but yet it ultimately is not Hegelian or Proustian. It's really just a quarter pounder, or just a rather irrespectable way of dealing with your second marriage.
Hegelian synthesis becomes a really elaborate rationalization for very ordinary human behavior. You know, I follow my characters. I just try to be true to them and to think them through and be very aware of the nuances and the subtleties. I've known people like Cassandra that are sort of rather self-impressed intellectuals, except they're just not as smart as they think they are. Yeah. You know, they talk the talk, they toss these words around, but they're amazingly glib and an inch deep. She doesn't mean to be. She does have a good mind. And she was raised with a certain affection for good books. And as she reveals, I think, bad books. She also had an affinity for bad books. She's, you know, the whole point of Cassandra Follows is that herself is somewhat inauthentic on many, many levels, except she doesn't know that. She's one of those people, and it gets tricky in fiction to write a person who is dangerously close to being an archetype, but except they really are a person, you know, sort of, and you meet people like that in life, people who don't know that they're a type. I was with a friend recently, and for some reason we were talking about certain stereotypes we carry about people who listen to National Public Radio, although I, in fact, listen to National Public Radio all the time, so I'm making fun of myself when I make fun of this stereotype. And my friend said, I can look around your room and tell you which person in the room has an NPR tote bag. And you know, because archetypes and stereotypes do, in fact, exist in life, they're fair game for the novelist. The trick is to write the person who's a stereotype, but who's still a person even in the midst of being a stereotype, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense, but at the same time, I would counter-argue that if you were going to go ahead and ding Cassandra for being book smart as opposed to people smart, is that not entirely fair to her? Because there is some value in being book smart, and people who are book smart and yet socially inept are still capable of functioning or finding a particular niche in society, and even also defying the stereotype.
And Cassandra is larger than the stereotype. There's a piece of her that fits within the stereotype. Ultimately, I hope people see her as fully human. One of the challenges in writing the book was wondering, will people stay with this character? Because she can be infuriating. I think by the end of the book, I always knew where she was going. I knew what her little journey was, but no one else had that advantage. And so it was a careful line to walk between sort of having gentle fun. And I think it's very gentle fun. I don't do broad satire. I'm not, you know, I'm not a comic writer, but I did have some gentle fun with Cassandra and her
I don't know about traits. That. If you're having gentle fun, essentially there is some comic part of you. And I'm wondering if you're possibly holding back from perhaps going further. I don't know.
I don't know. I think actually I'm doing about the right blend of comic writing in my work. I think it's got the right amount. I think if I tried to do more, it would become less and less effective. Sometimes,
why?
I really second guess the funny parts. There's a part of me that can't shake the idea that, you know, serious is better. You know, I am a bit enslaved to that notion. And I can't write something that's 100% serious, that has no levity to it. I just can't.
Yeah.
But, you know, a little goes a long way. And I really don't like what I call... There's certain books where the humor is about giving people, like, really big, funny, pompous names.
Yeah.
And the humor is very broad, and I don't like that at all. And
you
I
hate
don't
Pynchon,
want...
then. The Pynchonian names.
I will confess that I have never successfully completed a Pynchon novel.
That's perfectly fine.
I have
a lot
to
of
be
good
honest.
People have it.
I have tried, and so far I have failed. I have tried with Gravity's Rainbow over and over and over again, and I just haven't... Sometimes, you know, there's certain books, it feels a little bit like body surfing, and you just haven't caught the break you need yet that'll let you catch the wave and get into it. And so I do try over and over again, but, you know, that's not my objection to his work at all. I'm talking about crasser work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to name names.
But going back to this notion of tone and a certain percentage that you have to hit, I would counter-argue with that by saying, well, it's not necessarily about whether you're funny or serious, it's about whether you're true to your voice. Why are you looking at this scenario with a percentage or a ratio, I have to ask?
Well, I don't have an exact mathematical formula for it, but I think my big fear is that the humor becomes... The humor in the books, if I'm not careful, will function the way that self-deprecation functions in so many women's lives, where, oh, hi, I'm not sure you like my book, so let me tell a little funny story here and maybe you'll like me and you'll like my book. I don't want to fall back on being amusing in order to hold on to people. I don't want it to become a bad habit, something I take refuge in.
Yeah.
And, you know, I worked for a very long time. I worked for 20 years in offices, and I observed my male colleagues, and I noticed one thing that was very interesting about them is that when someone told them they did a good job, they usually said, thank you, or sometimes they might say, thank you, and, you know, it was really a very difficult assignment. And the women I worked with, whenever they were praised or complimented, it always swatted it down and had to turn it into a funny story about how inept and incompetent they were. And there's a risk of that for me in writing fiction of, oh, wait, I'm being really serious and I'm beginning to get full of myself, so I'll tell a funny story because so people will know that I don't take myself that seriously. And I don't want to give in to those little bouts of losing confidence. I don't want to be that self-deprecating when I'm sitting down to write. Writers need to be very bold,
yeah,
and very confident. I mean, to write is to be presumptuous, so just get over it. To think that you have a book to put on the shelf. I mean, we can all stop writing right now, and there are enough books that everyone could read very happily until the end of their lives. So to sit down is... I was about to say ballsy, but I really hate the word ballsy because technically I can't be ballsy. And I don't like that as a word for bravery and confidence, but...
Effrontery, I guess. But I mean, I would actually, again, sort of point out that maybe it's not so much about being bold or expressing effrontery as it is essentially just subconsciously plying it down onto the page and just not even worrying, not even being conscious, really, just going ahead and doing it. That really is the question, as opposed to just... You know, dwelling upon every little minutia of whether you've got a percentage or not. I mean,
I don't dwell on percentage, but I think I do work from an unconscious basis. But I'm trying to figure out what influences. I mean, even when you're unconscious, you're influenced by something. So I'm trying to figure out what is the unconscious impulse.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sitting there saying, oh, I'm not sitting there consciously saying I don't want to be too funny. But when I look at my work, I can tell that I am sparing with humor, that I allow myself some, but I pull back on it. And so I'm analyzing what might be affecting that unconscious choice.
I'm going to have to ask you, sort of related to this question and tying it back into life sentences, you have, of course... Calliope, Calliope, and Cassandra. I read Janet Maslin's review in the New York Times, and she seemed to be really hung up on the notion that this represented some Greek mythology. But when I read your book, I immediately said to myself, oh, well, this is a very funny little red herring to throw the reader off. Just as the dates that precede each particular section have no significant meaning, or a very little meaning, based on the narrative. And I'm wondering if little red herrings along these lines are intended to either see if the critics of the Janet Maslin streak are going to go ahead and latch onto them, or whether they represent a way for you to obtain this level of just doing it that you just described in this last answer.
It is true that both Cassandra and Calliope show up in the narrative, show up in my writing with their names attached to them. I did not sit down and schematically design a story in which, yes, I will create two characters named for classic figures from Greek mythology. Cassandra was Cassandra, and then I realized her father was a classics professor and began to think about all the things he would have... And Calliope was just always Calliope. There's a certain Baltimore-ness to it. But I'm a really big believer in found opportunity. And sometimes writers create our own found opportunities. So it's an accident that the two main characters of this novel have these names that have a lot of resonance, but I'm okay when people then sort of see the resonance and point it out. It's like someone looking at a painting and focusing on a detail that might not have been the intent, but it's in there. It is there. My belief is that if one is overly schematic in writing, it'll feel a little stale and airless.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I'm kind of delighted that people come to this and say, oh, Cassandra and Calliope, there's all this significance. Well, there is for them. They've found it, and it affects the way they read the story, and that's great. At the same time, I think if I had had a plan, I think the novel would be very... I think it would have a real contrived feeling to it. I think it would feel kind of pedantic, you know. And one of the things I didn't plan, you know, it just comes out. You're writing, and I write trying to think about who is this person and what would they be doing and what would they be thinking at this moment. And there's a scene where Cassandra has sex with someone that she's really been yearning for, and because Cassandra can't turn her head off ever, she's, you know, thinking and thinking, and for some reason she starts thinking about Leda and the swan, which if people are really paying attention and they've seen the bit about Portnoy's complaint in the book, that's very important in Portnoy's complaint. So Cassandra, probably whether she knows it or not, is actually channeling that book that she read as a kid, which she remembers seeing at her father's house. And so I'm writing this, and, you know, I don't remember every line of Leda and the Swan. And by the way, although I'm pretty well versed in Greek mythology, I didn't remember that Leda gave birth to Cassandra.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that. So I go back and I read the poem and I just think, oh my God, that's hilarious. And if I had planned it, if I'd been writing toward that moment steadily for days and days, oh, I can't wait until the moment that Cassandra invokes her, you know, namesake's mother via Yeats in bed, I think it would have felt a little off.
Sure.
So, you know, I work organically, but, you know, people have been having fun for years finding things in books and films that the writer may or may not have intended to be there, but if they find it, it's there on some level. It's there for them.
Yes. But also, the thing that's fascinating about these little scenarios in which they turn out to be different things is that they're also intriguing deflections. By way of sustaining a mystery, you are creating a deflection for the reader. And
constantly.
Therefore, it's almost a way for you to... I'm wondering to what level you're aware of these deflections. And this novel certainly has a great number of them right up to the very end. And so it's fascinating to me that what is being interpreted by a critic or even a reader as something of great import, something of tremendous symbolic value, is also, or perhaps not so, operating as a deflection so that the reader stumbling through this book or trying to make sense of the book is constantly bombarded with red herrings and the like. So I must ask whether this is a way to, I guess, take away this notion of consciousness, or if this is a way for you to have fun, or this is the very comic thing that you were telling me earlier in this conversation.
Can it be all of the above?
Yeah, sure, it could.
I mean, I think part of what I am very aware of trying to divert the reader's eye. When I sit down to write, I'm writing, I actually have a literal person in my mind for whom I'm writing, which is a mystery reader who reads a lot of books, 5 to 7 books a week. They've read every story. They read at a very high level. They read with an incredibly engaged, interactive mind. Some of these people, no matter how clever you are, tend to figure things out. So I was like, I have to write something that's going to keep them in the text, no matter what. But I'm also very aware that in an interesting way, the really, really smart, engaged reader is easier to, not fool, but it's easier to divert their eye. And this just came to me while I was sitting here. For some reason, I really have The Wizard of Oz on my brain today. I was a huge Oz fan. But I'm not thinking so much about The Wizard of Oz, but I think it's the second book, which is called The Land of Oz.
Yes.
I think I have that right. Wait, no. I'm thinking of the one in which Dorothy comes back and she meets Ozma.
Yeah.
And she meets Ozma. And it's the first time we meet the Gnome King. And, you know, the Gnome King has this nasty habit of turning everyone to an object. And he has this huge room filled with all these objects that he's created out of living things. And it's the suspense at the end of the book is that people have to guess. And they have to be able to guess where the missing royal family of Ev is. And, you know, in some ways, I'm trying to usher my readers into a room like that. Look at all the different shiny, fascinating objects. Can you pick the right one? Can you guess which one matters? Or can I just distract you a little bit more? And, you know, it's more fun to write for intelligent people. I mean, it's kind of interesting to me that can be a novel idea for some people. But it's more interesting to write with the idea that this is interactive, that I'm not handing down a sacred text that's carved in stone that can only be read the way I want it to be read, but that I like the idea that each reader brings an individual experience to the book. So I kind of stuff it full of stuff, put a lot of junk in there.
Well, on the notion of stuffing it full of stuff and working the novel, the sentences in this book seem to me much shorter than the sentences in your earlier books. There's still the concern for dashes, there's still the concern for clauses and the like, but there's more of a compact feel to many of these sentences in the sense, going back to what I was observing about using a literary name or a philosophical name as a modifier, that word creates a distinction. I must ask whether the sentences were more worked over with this particular book more so than the other ones, and why is that, and is there a certain risk perhaps in working over a sentence too much?
Well, yes, there definitely is a sentence, and there definitely is a risk in overworking sentences. And now I always go back to another Philip Roth novel I love, where Zuckerman Unbound, where Alvin Pepler confronts Zuckerman with this piece he's written, and Zuckerman says, "Oh, this one, please, it feels really overworked." And then he says, "Well, you're wrong. That was the sentence that came out the easiest. That came automatically." And he said, "Well, maybe that's the problem," you know, which of course makes Pepler insane, because it seems as if there's no right answer than if it can come too easily or if it can be overworked. Yeah, sentences are like pie crust. They're really easy to overwork.
Yeah.
That said, I just happen to believe that there's room for improvement in my writing. And I decided to push myself with this book and to try to write a book where when I got to the end, when I got to the final draft, where I might finally feel that every word in the book had earned its place on the page, that it was chosen and it was deliberate. I am still a little dash happy, going to work on that. But
oh, I like the dashes.
Oh, you like dashes?
Yeah,
I love dashes.
Dashes are great.
I love dashes, but I feel guilty about my proclivity for them.
Why? Dashes are great.
I feel guilty about a lot of things.
Emily Dickinson
clearly
liked her dashes, you know?
But she was Emily Dickinson. And I just really wanted to refine my own work, to feel very in control of it. I wanted it to be muscular. And I think part of it was, too, is that I was writing these two very different things. I was writing the real book, if you will, and then I was writing Cassandra's book, and I wanted there to be a very definite contrast. I found myself a couple of months ago talking to the writer Anne Hood, who has become a friend and whom I admire, and I said, hey, you know, when my book comes out, and she's written a very good memoir called Comfort, so when my book comes out and you see the sections that are supposed to be memoir, I want you to know that I don't think that's the height of memoir writing. I don't think that my character is a great writer, and I just want you to know that I don't think good memoirs are written in that smarmy voice.
Yeah.
So again, I think that was part of it, although that's not something I analyzed. I did something with this book I've never done before, but I'll probably never not do it again, which is I read it aloud twice. I used to read my books aloud at the proof stage just to catch errors, but this time on the final draft, I sat down and I think I read at the rate of about 40 pages a day, 20 in the morning, 20 in the afternoon, because it's actually quite exhausting.
Yeah.
The thing about reading it aloud is you can't skim, you don't miss anything, and you hear a lot, obviously. Most interestingly to me is that in reading aloud a book at that pace, a lot of continuity issues come to the fore. And if there's a word you're overusing, you're more likely to notice it in reading it aloud. And I think that's probably, I can only guess, but I think that probably resulted in this book having a slightly different feel to the writing.
Yeah.
Because I had said every word in this book is going to earn its keep.
At the same time, though, when you subject a book to this much scrutiny, there becomes a danger of not accepting or not letting go of a book at a particular time in your life. Every artist has this dilemma, where they go ahead and make something, and then, like, even 6 weeks later, they say to themselves, oh, God, it was awful. So, I mean, to what degree is reading the book 40 pages aloud every day a way of possibly countering this dilemma? Because you have to move on to the next one. And I know you do a book a year, and that's a really aggressive pace.
Luckily, I have worked with the same editor for my entire career. And when things got a little nutty, although that was before the reading aloud part, because I'm in a final draft by then, and I'm just reading the book to make sure that I was reading it for language more than anything else. She did have to talk me off the ledge at one point. I had a brief period where I believed the book was unpublishable, and it did need work at that time. It was just that I hadn't figured out what to do, and knowing that it needed something, not knowing what it needed, and my editor doesn't tell me what to do. She just tells me that things need to be done. And she, you know, gives me some advice, but she really wants me to find the answers on my own. And I admire that when I'm in the middle of it. I think to myself, please just tell me what to do. You know, I'm sort of a lifelong good girl. You know, given a set of instructions, I will follow them. And of course, so it's very productive actually to force me to figure it out on my own, not to do the thing that will please her, but to find the thing that will make it the best book it can be.
But to what degree should this even matter? Because there's a story like of William Gibson, when every time he writes a book, he basically goes ahead and complains to his wife. He says, oh, this is the worst thing I've ever written. And his wife basically tells him, oh, Bill, just go up there and finish the damn book. And to some degree, it seems to me that this could also likewise apply to this label that this book is somehow unpublishable. I mean, writing is in the act of it, in the midst of it, is not something with which one should subject oneself to some scrutiny like this. In fact, it's almost kind of more liberating, I would suspect, to just essentially not even worry about whether it's good or bad, and to trust, I suppose, your editor who knows what's going to work and what's not going to work, and to just simply do it. So I'm just wondering why it should even matter, because it seems to me almost like it's a hellish process more than a joyful process.
It was hellish that week.
Yeah.
But The first three drafts were done in the spirit you just described. And, you know, I'm writing right now. I've started a new novel. And I never worry in the early draft. This was at the end. This is where it was the fix-it draft. This is the last chance.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the thing that made it hard is that everyone agreed that it was, you know, kind of like 92% of the way there. That it needed small things. Very small things, which in some ways is the hardest note in the world to get. You know, I was a reporter for a really long time. I had stuff handed back to me that it was like watching something. It was like watching someone debone a fish, you know. And actually, the worst thing about being a reporter is it's like you turn in your copy, you turn in your perfectly broiled fish, and they debone it, and they take all the bones out, and then they say, okay, now rebone it.
Yeah.
Like, what? You know, so I've had all sorts of experiences, and this was one bad week. It was one very bad week. Although, even in the middle of that bad week, I was feeling pretty good about the book overall. I was just frustrated because it needed one more little fix, and I hadn't found it yet. And, you know, I think my work ethic is a saving grace. I think the fact that I get up every day and, you know, work Monday through Friday, and that I want to write a book a year. It's a pace that I inflict on myself because it keeps me honest. And it keeps you honest on so many levels. I mean, one of the best things in the world is to be writing a book when you're publishing a book, because now you're not completely invested in the book that you wrote last time. You have another book.
Yeah.
And if everyone shows up and hates the book you're publishing, you think, maybe they'll like this book I'm writing. I don't know. Maybe I can do it better next time.
But I'm wondering if you've ever contemplated shifting to, say, a book every 2 years, or to allowing a sort of wiggle room, perhaps, with which to figure out some of these lingering things of this fix-it period that seems to be a problem, I suppose.
I have contemplated it, and I'm not ready to do it yet, but I keep it in the back of my mind that it is my decision. And Mauro has told me that over and over again. I write at this pace. They will let me write at whatever pace I want to. And so, yeah, I'm kind of holding that chip, if you will, that if I need to slow down, that's in constant assessment for me. Well, that is to say, everything about writing is in constant assessment. Everything is, have I set my life up in the way that is allowing me to write the best books that I can? I mean, I think one of the big dangers is not having deadlines. And I worked with a lot of people who never let their copy go, who never, you know, just like, the, you know, were going back in long after it was done and really did make themselves crazy, and they were never, ever happy. I'm really comfortable with the idea that I'm going to spend the rest of my life writing things that are not perfect, that there is no perfection, and every time there will be something that I could have done better or smarter, there could have been one detail, or it can always be better, but that's great because that's a reason to do it again.
I want to shift back into life sentences. I have to talk to you about Tina, who works at Nordstrom, and she was a former policewoman. She accuses her octogenarian neighbor, Mr. Salvati, of racism because of the flub. Oh, white, of course. You then have Tina observe that Salvati came from a generation that was not particularly generous towards people unlike themselves. But he's being very generous in telling Tina that, hey, this person stopped by. Is it your suggestion that Tina is perhaps just as bad as Cassandra in assuming things about people, in essentially drawing upon these generalizations? Or what's the situation here? Is this a comparative point pointing out that Tina is just as culpable as Cassandra? Or?
In some ways, I don't think that was conscious, though. I mean, I was writing about the kind of exchange that is such a way of life in Baltimore. Yeah. I found this really wonderful car service that will take me to the airport for about the same cost as a taxi. And especially when, if I have to leave for the airport at 4:30 in the morning, I don't want to rely on the cabs of Baltimore, which are notorious for not showing up. And the thing is the guy, it's one guy, and he's taken me to the airport several times. And I just know, talking to him, that we're dangerously close to him saying something that I'm not going to be able to let pass.
Yeah.
It's just a mark of Baltimoreans of a certain generation. But, you know, Tina is a very damaged person. And part of the reason that Tina has that little exchange in her head, in my opinion, and, you know, by the way, notice I say in my opinion because your way of reading it makes absolute sense to me. It wasn't necessarily my intent, but now that you've suggested it to me, I really like it. But at the time, my intent was that what Tina is really seeking to do is catalog for herself all the ways she's not Mr. Salvati, because that who she is. That's who she's going to be. And, you know, and she even, you know, thinks that, it, you know, in 40 years from now, am I going to be driving to the Swallow at the Hollow to meet my future? Except she doesn't even have friends. And Tina is kind of constantly keeping track and taking inventory. She's not an alcoholic, according to her, because she's taken a test online and she's figured out she didn't have enough right answers, except she knows she is. She's not Mr. Salvati. She's not Callie Jenkins. She's constantly defining herself by saying that she doesn't have the weaknesses of the people that she sees around her, but she doesn't have any real identity.
Yeah.
And so that was more, but yeah, Tina and Cassandra, you know, Tina also has this very conscious moment in which she's amazed by Cassandra, because Cassandra's one of those people who can ask other people to do things for her, and Tina can't do that. And here's Tina doing things for Cassandra, has almost very quickly after meeting her become her very willing accomplice. And, you know, I feel that Tina is sort of the least fulfilled character in the book. She is not satisfied with how things turn out. You know, the last time we see her, she's having a conversation on the phone with Cassandra. And she cannot accept what the story is. It doesn't serve her. It doesn't work for her. And, you know, she's an incredibly sad character. One of the challenges in creating a character like Tina is that there really have been only 3 female homicide cops in the city of Baltimore off and on for the past 20 years. There are very few. And so I had to create someone so particular that no one could ever say it was one of those short, small group of women. And so Sestina is, you know, sort of a very quirky and particular character, in part because I wanted to make sure people knew that it's absolutely out of my imagination and I'm not.
But I also must bring up an early chapter in which Callie is driving. The chapter concludes, "Her hometown was a blank to her, a sketched-in background as plain as a child's drawing." And when recalling drawing in grade school, you write, "The men, their faces were blank, empty circles above crude suits and red ties. It was like trying to draw God." So the suggestion here is that Callie is fully aware of how impossible it is to create some sort of backstory out of nothing. So you have Cassandra, who is inventing things out of whole cloth, possibly. You have Tina, who has trained to look at people, and she's incapable of doing anything other than resorting to generalizations. And then you have Callie, who has accepted this 7-year prison sentence and has essentially conceded that, well, there's no possible way I could even look into this great expanse. And so this is very interesting to me in light of the overall thrust of the book, which is about how one comes to terms with memory. It's almost as if you're suggesting that, well, it's an impossibility, at least among these characters in this particular setting.
Memory is fallible.
Yeah.
And it's just... And then you start thinking about the implications of that statement. I was asked about it at one point this week, asked about going back to being a reporter. And I said, you know what would really be hard for me to, in terms of going back to be a reporter, is when you're a reporter, a lot of your reporting is based on other people's memories. And at this point, you know, it's very common as a reporter to say to someone, okay, what was said in the meeting and what did you say and what did he say? And after the past couple of years of thought that I've put into the world of memory, I know how wrong people's memories can be. They just can be, even when they're not being malicious, even when they're not trying. People just get things wrong all the time. Now, Callie in particular, she can't draw men. Men are a void for her. She doesn't understand them. She didn't have a father. You know, she clearly is just ill-equipped in a way to deal with men. That, you know, she invests them with a lot of power, and yet she can't really see them. It's very important. Callie can't really see men. You know, Cassandra, whatever Cassandra's flaws, she's utterly sincere and has told her life story to what she believes is the best of her ability. She thinks she's telling the truth.
But if it's based on fallible memory, what then is the purpose of the exercise? What then is the purpose of corralling memories together? That's the intriguing question you
what
bring
is,
up. Why? Yeah.
What is the purpose of the exercise? It's my understanding now that generally it's accepted that memoir is a story that is told as the teller remembers it. And okay, I'm all right with that. But then there's a passage in Truth and Beauty. It probably is part of the reason I wrote this book, because I love memoirs. I love Truth and Beauty by Ann Patchett about her friendship with Lucy Greeley. This passage really troubles me. And to this day, I can't make peace with it. I can't say it's wrong. I can't say it's right. I can just say I'm bothered by it. Patchett, in writing about Lucy Greeley's memoir about her life, Autobiography of a Face, said that people were constantly coming up to Greeley and saying, "How did you remember all of this?" And Greeley would say, "I didn't remember it. I wrote it. I'm a writer." And it is clear to me from this passage that Patchett approves of this logic, which is that because Lucy was a good writer, a poet with a strong voice, she was creating art. Now, she doesn't say, and maybe she doesn't even mean, that that gives her a certain license to get it wrong or to make stuff up even. But I've always inferred that's what she's saying. And so then I come back to the idea of, well, wait, are you saying that if you're a good enough writer, you get to make stuff up? I have a really pedantic part of my brain that cannot go there. And I can read memoirs and even enjoy memoirs that do things I would never do. But I was a reporter for 20 years. I can't write something that's a composite scene, or that I could never invent dialogue. I could try to recreate dialogue and would admit every step of the way how fallible my memory is. But the idea that I would sort of boldly say, "I wrote it," I never. And I'm circling that idea like a dog with a bone, and I just can't quite decide what to do with it.
But then you also base, in this novel, Callie's scenario on a true crime.
Yes.
Scenario. So the question is it possible that you fall into the same trap that Cassandra falls into, or by way of it being a novel, or by way of it being transmuted, that it avoids this Patchett-like logic?
I hope it's the latter. I mean, yes, I used a real-life case for inspiration, but I'm pretty sure that the character I created is not at all like the real life person who inspired the story, that they're very, very different people in every way. And their stories are different in some really key ways. I mean, I look to real life and I see things that interest me, but as soon as I sort of take them off to my corner and start to tinker with them, they're not the real life stories anymore. And they're generally, outside of Baltimore, they're generally not well-known stories. So I'm not picking them for their resonance. I'm not picking them because people will say, "Oh yeah, that famous..." I'm not writing about the Lindbergh kidnapping. No one has any, outside of Baltimore, no one has any associations to bring to this. So it's not that it was real, it was something that was fascinating to me because it indicated an extraordinary discipline and will.
But you bring up the Lindbergh kidnapping and therefore you apply a criteria to it of fame or well-known story, and every person's story that you lift from is just as important, perhaps, or just as unique, or just as idiosyncratic,
oh,
or whatnot.
Absolutely.
So you almost can't even make that distinction if we're to take this side of, like, well, what is the ethical dilemma of taking?
I can't make that, in terms of ethics. I can't make that distinction. I'm just making the distinction that I'm not using real life as a handy-dandy shortcut to do some of the heavy lifting for me. If you write about a case that's really famous, there's a certain shorthand that is inevitable. You know, if you decide you're going to write a fictionalized treatment of something very, very famous, it's because you want the advantages of people arriving at your book with a certain set of ideas about what they think happened. And, you know, it's true. You know, there are people who are connected to the real life case who would read this and they would be troubled by it. And you know what? I'm still kind of working on that myself. And I've actually, while touring for this book, have invited people in my audiences to argue with me over it. And I'll say, look, I think what I do is very different from what Law and Order does. I don't think I rip things from the headlines. I don't think I'm trying to do something easy, but maybe you think it is. And I would like to hear from you. And I talk about this at great length, and I've really been trying to get someone to fight with me. I haven't gotten anyone to take me up on it yet.
Well, I could also suggest that because you have to draw on something for fiction, you have to draw on something real in order for it to be real to other people. Maybe such a distinction isn't even necessary. Maybe you can justify, particularly in a novel form, oh, I can lift from here, I can lift from here, and it kind of just all congeals together into this happy narrative. Therefore, maybe it's not even a question worth arguing over.
I mean, there's a part of me that wants to say that. I am really open to people fighting with me. I kind of want them to do it more. I've really just, you know, I've just arrived at some space in my life where I have a lot of equilibrium. A week ago, you know, I got an email. Here's my rule. If you sign your name to it, or if you say it to my face, if you send an email and you sign your name, I'll answer you. And if I don't answer, it's just an oversight because I got overwhelmed. And if you come up to me at a book signing and you want to buttonhole me and talk to me about something, that's, you know, if you're there, you're talking to me. So, you know, I had someone write me a week ago and tell me that my books was the most boring book they'd ever read in their life, that it was boring on every single page, that they thought it might get interesting in the end, but no, that was boring too. And they write, "You triumphed," which I actually thought was kind of funny. And I wrote back and said, "Thank you for writing." They signed their name. So, I have this concern with ethics because I find Cassandra Fallow's ethics appalling. I mean, they're really troubling to me. She doesn't know what she's doing. I don't know if people reading my work have picked up on the fact that one thing I am consciously writing about often, not always, is the dangers of amateurism. Which is not meant to be an attack on the amateur sleuth subgenre, but just that people need to sort of be careful about the task they assign themselves and to realize that, you know, when you just suddenly decide you're going to be an amateur investigator, you might wreak some havoc. You know, that maybe there's a reason that there are professionals who do certain jobs, and Cassandra doesn't know what she's doing. She's not even a journalist.
Yeah, and in fact, her childhood dream is to become an investigative journalist, something she doesn't take up. However, if you go ahead and take that route, you'd have to then discount guys like Heinrich Schliemann, who discovered Troy, you know,
yes,
out of sheer zeal. So I'm not certain if it could be labeled on amateur versus professional, as it is methodology, as it is, an amateur can be perhaps even more prodigious in her pursuits than a professional.
That's true, and they can bring a real zeal to it. But sometimes, you know, there can be dangers. There can be dangers to not knowing what you're doing. I guess that sounds really obvious and dull when expressed that way. Cassandra doesn't have a clue what she's doing. You know, she doesn't begin to think about the ways it can reverberate through other people's lives.
But I mean, to what extent should one even have a clue about what one is doing? I mean, often life is essentially random and perfunctory and also simultaneously anarchic. I mean, sometimes one has to fake it. And therefore, I'm not certain if not knowing what one is doing is necessarily a sign of weakness.
I think you have to be conscious of how what you do, what you choose to do, affects other people. You know, I do think you have to keep other people in mind. Cassandra has completely lost sight of the fact that there are human beings involved in this story. It's not just a thing to be put on paper. that if she does, if she thought about it, which she doesn't, there are going to be ramifications no matter what she finds out. She's going to affect people, whatever she does. And she never stops to think about that when she sets off on her little quest. I mean, I've said this before, but I'll risk repeating myself. One of the things I worry most about in crime fiction, which I love and am a happy practitioner of, is that sometimes we lose sight of the victims. And we begin piling up these bodies so that some detective can have a really good personal epiphany. It's like, well, 17 prostitutes are dead, but the detective went home and hugged his son.
Yeah.
And I find that offensive. And, you know, that's where you lose sight of the fact that every person in the story should be fully human.
Yeah. I'll ask one last question. It relates to the memoir that is contained within Life Sentences, and it also relates to a kind of curiosity I've had about your reluctance to use the first-person perspective. I mean, it's there in the first Tess Monahan book. It's there in some of your short stories. But it's not really been there in most of your work, and I'm curious as to why this is. The memoir is interesting because it is essentially first person, but it also seemed to me that if you had written a chunk of the narrative in a first person manner, you almost could have duped the reader even more. I'm wondering why your reluctance to use the first person is evident, or do you have a reluctance, or why do you not use the first person? And go for it.
I think I get sloppy in first person. I think I get indulgent. I think the first Tess Monahan book was written for two drafts in first person. And then actually it's in third person. But I have used the first person voice in very contained situations. Usually I think when the people are about as different from me as they can possibly be, I feel that I lack discipline writing in the first person. I am just a little too pleased with myself. It's great that you asked me this question because you're absolutely on the money. I have a real problem with it. I don't feel that I can nail it. And I haven't found the book yet. I mean, I'd sort of like to do it. I would like to do it, but I haven't found the right book yet.
Why not try?
For some reason, it just doesn't work for me yet. I mean, I keep saying yet, but I just sort of feel like everything starts to disintegrate when I use first person.
How so?
I feel that the writing gets fuzzy and that it becomes, that I pile on words, lots of extraneous words, and I really become a pleaser when I write in first person. It's like I feel like I'm doing this desperate little tap dance, and I'm trying so hard to make people like me when I write in first person. If I were writing in first person in a character who is close to me.
But what if you were to write something in first person in which this wasn't even a distinction? What if you were to write like a truly scummy character who you wouldn't have to worry about this question of being liked or not? It would just be a perspective.
Well, it's interesting. I have a character like that in the novel I'm working on. Maybe I should try to write his sections in first person.
Yeah.
You know, I think also the first person voice, it's kind of a bizarre aesthetic issue for me, which is, why and when are they telling this story? You know, in Lolita, at least I know exactly what he's doing. He's writing a confession. But I always kind of wonder in this bizarre, completely sort of anti-intellectual way, which, why did someone just sit down and tell me that story that went on for 100,000 words?
You know, what you've essentially done is annulled the purpose of Sunset Boulevard. I mean, you know, you got to somehow, I guess, suspend your disbelief because you get so sucked into the narrative that
I suspend my disbelief over and over again when I'm reading. But when I'm writing, it just doesn't come. I was going to say, it's not about coming naturally. what comes out, I don't think is very good. And I just don't like it. And I haven't found yet the material that seems to work for me in first person. I mean, I'm trying to remember what I have written in first person. One of the Tess Monahan novels has a beginning and an end, a prologue and an epilogue, that are first person in the voice of her boyfriend, which are passages I like very much. I could write in his voice, it turned out. I mean, one of the more daring things I've ever done is write a short story set in New Orleans in the first person voice of a young black man who's a native New Orleanian, and that was really tricky, but yet at the same time he was absolutely had to be first person. That's true. And, you know, and right now I don't have a good memory, as it should be stated over and over again when I'm talking about life sentences. Those are the two examples I can remember. There might be another short story that I'm leaving out, but wow, now I want to go and just think about this for a long time.
I'm wondering if this reticence to write in the first person has much to do with control or this idea of being daring. I mean, I don't know. I come and I say, hey, be daring. I say this to anybody, but I say this also to you. Maybe there is this element of possible evolution if you were to write in first person that you were talking about earlier. You wanted to evolve in your writing, and would this possibly be a way to do it?
It could be a future challenge.
Yeah.
Could be. It awaits the right book, and I'm not sure I found that yet, but I don't know what I'll be writing next year or the year after that. I hope I will be writing. Yeah, I think, if I'm going to be honest about it, and I try to be honest all the time, I think there are certain control issues and even bizarrely privacy issues. That it feels even more naked to write in the first person, to put in. Finally, I think that a big part of it is having a background in journalism, you know, where you really have the eye kind of stomped out of you, and it's hard. That may be sort of like the last part of the journey, because that is something that in journalism, you know, I probably over 20 years maybe availed myself of first person a dozen times, tops. And the funny thing is when you're a journalist, you think, especially when you're a young journalist, or I'll just say when I was a young journalist, you know, I wanted to be a columnist. I wanted that first person voice. And now I'm kind of sickened by it in a lot of journalism. No, not in fiction. In fiction, it can be quite beautiful. I hate the current trend of filtering important world issues through the first person persona of someone who happens to have a column in a major American newspaper. I just, you know, I find it dreary as hell and really insulting, actually. You know, it's like, I don't need to experience the inauguration through this persona. Could you just tell me what happened? Maybe you could go talk to some other people. I remember when reporters used to do that. And, you know, it's really lazy. I can't stand the laziness of the first person in journalism, in newspaper journalism.